This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Let's get started. Good afternoon, history lovers and land lovers. Welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul, the first of two as part of the Dublin Festival of History, which kicks off this weekend. Now, in 1986, the maritime historian John de Courcy Ireland wrote, quote, "The lives of island peoples like Ireland's have been dominated by the seas encircling them, yet this fact has been largely ignored by Irish historians," unquote. So this afternoon we pose the question, is Irish history still sea blind? And to address this, I'm joined by Angela Byrne of the Dictionary of Irish Biography. On my right, Lar Joy, Heritage Director of Dublin Port. And on my far left, Captain Michael McKenna, who's Dublin Port Harbour Master. So that makes two masters on the podium here today. I'm the HedgeGhoul Master. Now, our fourth speaker, David Murphy of Maynooth University, unfortunately couldn't be with us. He's down with COVID. It hasn't gone away, you know. And he actually lost his voice, which is the best excuse I've ever heard for pulling out of a HedgeGhoul. Anyway, we wish David a full recovery. Now, I can see several people here who are familiar with the HedgeGhoul format, but for those of you who are not, do enjoy the discussion, but don't relax too much. You are at school, and you will be expected to sit up straight in your seat, pay attention, and participate in the discussion. So I will take questions from the floor throughout the discussion, not just a Q&A at the end. So if you want to skewer one of the panelists here with a difficult question, just put your hand up, and I'll try and bring you into the conversation. Now, Lara, to get us started, right, what do we mean by sea blindness? Explain.
So sea blindness is something that actually John de Courcy Ireland kind of defined in his book on the fishing industry. He said around the 1850s, the intellectuals, the Irish intellectuals, lost contact with the Irish Sea, and that lasted until the beginning of the emergency. And what he felt was that there had been a kind of turning of our backs to the sea, and that we forgot about the sea. And it only became a kind of priority for the Irish government in the 20th century when we started realising that we needed our own merchant navy. And that's how we got Irish Shipping created in 1941. So he kind of started that kind of idea, but it kind of continues around the world. There's a kind of concern around the world at the moment that the sea blindness is not just an Irish problem, it's a problem that suffers in countries such as America. So in 1900, there were 14,000 ships in the American merchant fleet. Today, there's only 300. When you look at how many American registered ships there are, there's only about 800 registered ships. But ships today are now registered in places like Liberia, Panama, and China, and Hong Kong. So there's kind of a disconnect about where our shipping is, how goods come to us. And one of the things I've realized kind of working here for the last 7 years is that people don't realize how we are dependent on Dublin Port, but all the ports that are there. So this is a challenge that we only kind of realize when there's a kind of blockage in a port that maybe we're over-reliant on the supply chain that begins in Europe and then comes to Ireland. And when I started working here in Dublin Port, a colleague said to me that ports are like toilets. We only appreciate them when they're blocked. And I thought that was... I thought it was a very crude way of describing it when I first started, but now 7 years later, I'm using that example. And that's a reality, and kind of Mike would have more experience of it, but in particular during 2018, when the port was closed down a couple of times due to Ophelia and the other storms, Ireland started running out of foodstuff. It ran out of bread very quickly because flour couldn't be imported. So this kind of concept of sea blindness goes back into history, but it's also a present-day concern that we seem to kind of forget that we live on an island.
Now, Michael, as the only sailor on the panel, right, just to illustrate what Lars talked about, how did your career guidance teacher or your friends react to the news that you were planning to go to sea? I mean...
Yeah, I suppose there was, from a very early age, I wanted to go off to sea and follow my dad's career and others. And I remember getting into secondary school and talking to a career guidance teacher and saying I wanted to become a deck officer, which is a navigation officer on the ship. And it was just a blank look of what that is, even from the career guidance side of things. And the training is through the CAO system, through the Nautical College down in Cork. So it's not the far side of the world, it's all here. And thankfully, the principal of the school, Dermot Murphy is his name, or was his name, he's retired now, was a yacht master. and sailed a lot offshore, not just inshore sailing. So he knew what that was. So all the career guidance I happened to get was, in fact, thankfully, from him. And it was a mystery to everybody else, other teachers and colleagues, as to why you would want to go to sea. What was that? What did that entail? What do people at sea do? I don't think there was even the linkage that people at sea transport the cargo that we all depend on a daily basis.
And when you return from your trips, like, what sort of reaction did you get? Like, were you coming from another planet or something?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. Yeah, when I first went to sea, which would have been back in 1992, I worked for a company called ExxonMobil, so that was on oil tankers. And very fortunate to spend an awful lot of time out in the South Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, those places. So you'd be away for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. And you were planned to be away for 4 months, but it could extend to 6 months. And you'd arrive home to, you know, colleagues and friends then, and trying to almost justify why you'd been away and what it was you were doing. Never mind the fact that everybody had been putting petrol in their car every day in the 4 months that you'd been away. I remember one particular evening I was coming to meet some friends in town, and I was getting a taxi into town, but it was a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, so as far as the taxi driver was concerned, it was a school night. You know, how come you're heading out to town on that when everybody else is getting ready for work in the morning? And I explained to this taxi driver that I'd been away for 4 or 5 months and working on an oil tanker. And there was the usual conversation that you have, a very nice chap he was, and he was, "Oh, okay, and where were you on the oil tanker?" And I said, "Oh, I was transporting oil from the Persian Gulf around to Singapore, and then oftentimes from Singapore out to the Pacific Islands." And he was like, "Okay." He said, "Must have been a really big truck." Yeah. And I said, and I've always remembered that, because I think I just sort of went, yeah, it was a big truck.
So he was like a tanker on the back of a...
Yeah, of course, yeah. But again, just that disconnect, not just that poor gentleman, that there are oil tankers on the high seas, warehouses on the high seas, and we can see them all on the, you know, you track your airplane or the flight radar, or you can see the app. We'd spend our life in the harbour looking at that to see where all the ships are on the way from South America, on the way from Europe, on the way from France up to Dublin, and tracking them. And they are the warehouses on the high seas, and they're all just moving towards us on a conveyor belt almost, you know.
Now, I just want to move on to the history side of this whole discussion, and just to put some boundaries in this, I think I'm not going to start by saying Brendan or the Vikings or whatever. In maritime terms, Ireland moved from the periphery to the centre with the opening up of the Atlantic world in the 16th and 17th centuries. So I'm going to start the discussion from there. Now, that period also coincided with the conquest of Ireland, which was, you know, completed by the 1690s. Now, Angela, could that be one of the reasons for sea blindness? In other words, that it's associated with British conquest, with tales of derring do, hornblower, master and commander, you know, all those series that Kevin Myers likes. So is our concept of the sea wrapped up with our concept of empire?
Yeah, I think to a large extent that's true. And of course, for many of you, when you think about maritime history and you think about individuals, right, you'll think about Admiral William Brown in Argentina. You'll think about Commandant John Barry, who's one of the founders of the US Navy. You'll think about individuals like that, and you'll think about individual explorers like Tom Crean. And a lot of the kind of popular knowledge of maritime history will hinge on a few stories of a few exceptional individuals, but of course they're not the whole story. And to take Tommy's invitation to go back to the 16th century, of course, Ferdinand Braudel, the great continental historian, described that Atlantic corridor from Ireland down along the coast of France and the Iberian Peninsula as the nursery of Atlantic exploration. And Ireland was absolutely tied up in that world in the early modern period. You know, by the 15th century, you've the O'Donnell of Tyrconnell being described in British documentary records as the king of the fish, and it's recorded the extent of his trade, herring, the silver of the sea, he's trading on the continent for wine and luxury goods. So the whole history even of the Gaelic world and Gaelic social and cultural life is bound up with that maritime highway running down along the eastern Atlantic coast. And then, like, the work of Audrey Horning, for example, has shown how Galway was an important node on that Atlantic world. She's demonstrated how Galway shipwrights were instrumental in things like repairing and servicing vessels that were heading to Newfoundland. And then, conversely, the goods that were being brought into Galway were an important part of the social and cultural life of the Gaelic lords in Galway. They were a window onto the continent for the Gaelic people in Galway. And then moving kind of into the 18th century, of course, it's impossible to talk about it without referencing the Caribbean slave trade. And the Irish, of course, were important in that in terms of the poorer people who went there in their thousands to settle, but also, as we're recently acknowledging and shedding more light on, in terms of actually their role as business people and owners and investors in the plantations and in the traffic and enslavement of African people. And the decolonisation discussion that we're having at the moment actually, I think, is an invitation to reinvigorate the discussion on the Irish role in that element of the Atlantic maritime history. And I'll finish very soon, Tommy, just because I've mentioned Atlantic history and the Atlantic space a few times. That kind of Atlantic studies was really in vogue about 15 or 20 years ago, but I think there's a lot more we could do in terms of investigating Ireland specifically within that role. Like, I've taught a lot of history of empire when I was a lecturer, and that kind of whole Atlantic study space was really valuable to explore the British Empire, but I think there's still a lot more potential there to explore the Irish role in that.
Laura, do you want to come in on that? I mean, I'm just wondering, can we blame the BBC for this? You know, I mean, I tend to listen to the news on the BBC Radio 4, and then the shipping forecast, north of Sierra, south of Sierra, you know, and then they're mapping out this whole area, and the implication is these waters are ours, you know. And it's a subliminal message as you nod off to sleep, you know. What do you reckon?
No, definitely. I mean, in the 1600s and the early 1700s, there's, you know, huge links into continental Europe, and there's various studies that, for say, Dublin Port, maybe 60% of the trade is going into Europe at that stage. But as the battle between the French and the English navies, the British navies, happens between 1688 up to the middle of the 1700s, eventually the British win, and they do kind of take own and are in control of the waves. And that's cemented then during the Napoleonic Wars. So definitely when you kind of move away from the Atlantic world and into empire, from an Irish context, this could be something else that kind of ties in with John de Courcy's theory, is that we also turn our backs to the sea in the 1800s, because very much we're no longer in charge or kind of can relate to the sea, because it's very much an English or British context. So in the 1700s, Dublin Port is expanding. There's a lot of money to be made here. This wall that you see here in the ground is an example of that. That's a ballast office, a subcommittee of Dublin Corporation is established, and the company today traces history back to 1708. And what that ballast office is doing is trying to create depth in Dublin and builds this wall, the east wall, by extending from North Wall Strand all the way down to here and fills in the bay, if you like. And by doing that, it's creating a channel and making the Liffey deeper, and eventually it starts off building the Great South Wall. So Dublin's kind of booming in 1700s because the port is doing very well. And by creating depth, the big challenge for shipping is that the ships are getting bigger, and that means more goods are coming in. And when you look at the, and not all the manifest lists survive, but when you do look at the reports, you see kind of a booming trade between ourselves and around the world. And as you were saying, a booming trade with the new colonies.
Does it, how far up the river did the ships go?
So when the Vikings were here, sorry, Tommy, going back that far, the ships went up as far as the medieval core, which is the area around the Dublin Castle. But by the 1700s, the ships are getting bigger and bigger. And Dublin is a very shallow bay. So there's a continuous chase for depth. So people are trying to get the big ships in, but the sandbars are moving back and forth across the channel, and quite often the ships are getting stuck. So by building walls like the Great South Wall and the North Bull Wall, which are there today, what you're doing is allowing the river to get depth. And that is kind of clever engineering from 300 years ago. And in many ways, we're reliant on keeping the port open today by that. So that was the main aim. But the 1700s are very much a period of kind of boom for the company, the ballast office, and its various kind of different changes over the years. And what you do start to see from, you know, the Act of Union, that the focus is very much less trade coming into to Dublin, and we've become an appendage to Liverpool.
Just hold that thought for a minute, lad, because I want to bring Michael in here. Michael, who are the key people involved then in building these key walls that solve this problem?
I suppose there was Bildon Bloodstoney, who's behind us here, represented on one of the pictures behind us for building the key walls with the use eventually was done with our diving bell, which is up on Sir John Rogerson's Quay there. But even in the planning elements of what Lara said there, the Great South Wall and the North Bull Wall, Captain Bligh of the Admiralty at the time, so if anybody's familiar with the movie Mutiny on the Bligh, which of course is based on a factual event when he had made his way back to London, and his next assignment was with the Hydrographic Office and to go out and do surveys, and he was dispatched over to Dublin. And I think it was just over a month he was here, a month or 3 months now, I'm not sure. It was a relatively short period of time to study the tidal streams and the water movement in and around the bay to try and help with the safe navigation of ships. And the Great South Wall was in place at that stage, had been built.
But was the South Wall meant to be the final solution to this problem, right? Or, like, in other words, this whole thing, I mean, they ended up with the two walls like a kind of a valve.
Yeah.
Did that evolve organically by accident, if you know what I mean? Or was it planned to be like that right from the start?
So I suppose with, you know, with all these things, there was steps in it. You talk about the sandbars moving across and ships trying to find their way in, and still many ports today have those challenges, have those challenges down in Wexford, for example. But the Great South Wall would have done one of the key issues, which was protecting from the waves and the swell coming into the port, but still would have not necessarily resulted in the same depth that was achieved once the North Bull Wall was achieved. So after he completed his studies, he recommended, as some others did in Dublin here, that there was a second wall to be built. I think his recommendation was actually that it would be parallel to the Great South Wall. And as it was built, now, as we know it, the Great South Wall goes almost east, and the North Bull Wall is at a different angle. And that narrow gap is what leads to that scouring that we talk about, which pushed the river out through the sandbar and created a gap in the sandbar, which, of course, eventually led to the creation of Dolly Beach. And if every engineering solution led hundreds of years later to what's, you know, a fantastic...
And Bull Island as well.
That's what I mean, yeah, Bull Island, yeah.
Because if you go on Bull Island today, you'll notice there are, changing huts, but they're like 50 metres back from the shoreline. Like,
yeah.
Bull Island is still growing.
It's still indeed growing. And could indeed reach... you know, bridge the gap all the way to Sutton.
Can I bring Angela in here? Because this presumably there's maritime heritage all over the country of this nature.
Yeah, and I'm the author for the forthcoming Historic Towns Atlas volume on Ballyshannon. So
Ballyshannon.
Yeah. And actually hearing about the works that were done in Dublin Port, and I have an awareness of them, but poor old Ballyshannon, the traders were lobbying in the 18th and early 19th century for remedial works because of the sandbar there, and came to nothing. But the built heritage there, it's almost like it's hidden in plain sight. So there was an extensive ice house from the late 18th through to the 19th century for the packing of fish and ice for export to Liverpool. And until the early 20th century, there was fish being exported from Ballyshannon and Killybegs as far as Russia. And again, that's the famous herring, because Donegal Bay was
nobody ever told me that as a kid at school. Never.
Oh, well, I'm going to be shouting from the rooftops about Ballyshannon's global connections for the next while to anyone who will listen. And the quays there are significant. There were several slips and quays and really important warehouses that within my lifetime, a lot of them on the south of the Erne have dilapidated, but on the north bank of the Erne, there's still some significant warehouses.
All derelict now.
I was inside one of them. We had an event for Heritage Week, Mulligan's warehouse there. But that street, the Mall, if anybody knows Ballyshannon, it runs parallel to the Erne on the north side of the Erne. And it ran from the castle to the harbour. It's one of the oldest streets, I argue, in County Donegal, and one of the most historic streets in the whole county. So against that notion that the built heritage of our maritime history is all around us, it's hiding in plain sight, and you just have to peel back a little bit to find that.
Just in the interest of complete disclosure here, right, my father worked in the ESB, he worked on the construction of the hydro dam there, right, which in a way completely wrecked the town, the falls were gone. I'm only really I'm subsumed by guilt now, you know, later in life. I actually went back into the head school of Ballyshannon a few years ago on this topic, you know.
It's true.
It couldn't be built now. Something like that couldn't be built now.
No.
So I knew it took out not just one set of falls, two sets of falls, but you've just reminded me that it also completely obliterated the harbour that was there, because the whole flow of the river changed. I mean, my mother, before the dam was built, remembers people emigrating from Ballyshannon, from the port. You know,
yeah.
But it was, it's completely gone now.
Yeah, part of the, so Ballyshannon suffered kind of waves in its decimation as a port town because it was a small but thriving port town, and that'll be news to a lot of people here. I've done a bit of work on the emigration from the town. It was small but a steady trickle up until about the 1850s when the railway came, and passengers could then go on to Derry much more easily and avail of the larger steamboats that were leaving from Derry via Mobile to North America. So that was one problem. And then from the 1830s, I mean, Irish shipping is deteriorating more generally, and Michael and Lard know a lot more about that than me. But with the cementation, as it's known locally, the building of the hydroelectric plant, one of Ballyshannon's biggest attractions is obliterated, and that's the Salmon Leap, which had been a tourist attraction to rival Killarney and the Wicklow Mountains since the 1750s. And a local person, the only voice to object to that decimation, said, "Shall we this gem destroy?" And there was no value put on that tourism heritage or the maritime heritage of that town that went back a couple of hundred years, and actually probably as far back as the 15th century.
Yeah, the big argument at the time, you see, was it would provide employment, and of course thousands were employed on the construction, and 200 were employed in the power station initially. But of course now, and it was the biggest employer in the town. Now today, there are 20 people employed in the power station, and is still the biggest employer in the town, sadly.
But you know, the locals were also told,
that's another
you'll get the electricity first, yeah. You'll have the best electricity.
This gentleman here wants to, yeah.
I bring us gently back to the theme of what we're talking about, which is sea blindness.
Yeah.
I'm ex-Merchant Navy myself, and like Michael here, I know your dad, Peter, quite well. Good bloke, yeah. And when you come back from sea, this is 1970s, early 1980s, you've been all over the world, at the time when people didn't go away. And first thing they'd ask you, when are you going back again?
That's right.
Yeah. There you are. And I'll tell you the reason why you have sea blindness in this country. Because for the most part, it's out of sight, out of mind. The job is done away. You could turn around and you know what a motor mechanic does. You won't know what an electrician does. Do you know what a tiffy does in the Royal Navy? Do you know kind of we'd say what, let's say, blokes do, you know my job, which was a sparky? What we do, radio officer, not the electrician. And you look at this, and I've been fortunate enough to, I'm the current president of the Maritime Institute. I was out in the museum this morning. We did quite good business, and we're doing quite well. And I suppose I had the pleasure and honour to work with John de Courcy Ireland. And John de Courcy Ireland would get a good head of steam up over this sea blindness. It used to annoy the man immensely. It never annoyed me, because people for the most part didn't know what we were talking about. So therefore you've got to turn around and you've got to say, it is an information job. And the information we're doing at the moment, I'm sorry the chap from Maynooth University wasn't here, because basically, I think part of the problem, you mentioned about your career guidance teacher being clueless. You were looking at the fact the Bosnian was a yacht master and he was able to help you. But I think myself, we're helping people in the museum in our very good library. We're helping students to do marine projects in the Leaving Cert. For the most part, they have a seagoing background. Somebody has been at sea and there's an interest in the thing. We're getting them from the Sea Scouts too. We're getting them at undergraduate level, kind of from the universities. And I think a huge problem we have in terms of the supervisors in the universities is the fact the majority wouldn't know the front from the back of a boat. So with the result, they are very, very reluctant to recommend students. They play to their strengths. Now, we have helped people. We have, in the last few years, we have helped to investigate the American Navy in Cove. We've helped to investigate Dublin Port. We're also helping with postgraduate people. Indeed, I'm a postgraduate myself. I have an MA and a PhD in Naval Studies. And I basically went to the UK. And the sad and promises the fact, I don't think, and I'm not being facetious in this now, but I genuinely don't think there was the level of expertise in the Irish universities to supervise me in the topics I wanted to do. Now, I'm not in any sense annoyed about this. It's a reality of life, but I think it would be extremely interesting to see investigate this concept of sea blindness. It is there, there's no doubt about it. But what can we do about it? You know, there's things like very nice programs, kind of the coastlines that's on at the moment. LARC, kind of, we'd say, has done incredible work down here in getting these archives going. And but there's a big job, and I'd like to hear people's opinions on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, this, yeah. You're starting early here, guys. Very good.
can I just ask quite a specific question? You mentioned the importance or the contribution that the Irish made to the 18th century transatlantic trade and shipping. Was there any Irish participation in the slave trade, which was very, very large part of the transatlantic trade?
Could I answer that? Just, I have a short answer for it. The person who got the biggest payout from the British government on the abolition of the slave trade in Britain was an Irish person. We cannot walk away from our part in that dark chapter in human history. That's the short answer.
Although, just quickly on that, the reason we have that information, though, is because of Daniel O'Connell. It was Daniel O'Connell insisted that the people compensated for the, you know, the abolition of for their, you know, their slaves would be publicly listed. So, you know, just to balance the picture out here. And, of course, it's a huge resource. But anyway, sorry, Angela, yeah.
No, that's it was just to give a short answer immediately to your question. Thank you for that question.
My question really centres around something that has just been mentioned and indeed adverted to broadly by your good selves, a travelled man in the Atlantic and the Pacific, etc., etc., and the history of the Dublin port with Bligh. My interest is a question to try to get an answer, and it comes back to the, more or less the empire, the slave trade, the creation of all of that, and the Irish involvement. I suppose the point I'm making is the name for today, are we sea blind in Ireland? Are we sea blind? Whereas I'd like to turn it on its head and ask another question. Are we deemed to be blind by people from abroad looking at us about our involvement in the sea and the expansion of the empire, which gets very little mention? I mean, one of the areas of my own interest has been Captain Cook and his voyages and the involvement of a large number of his crew who were Irish and Irish born, including the surgeon who saved Captain Cook's life, Surgeon James Patton, a Dublin man. And what would the empire be if Captain Cook had died without the assistance of Surgeon Patton in the middle of the Pacific? And what really prompted this question, are they looking at us blindly, was when I was in New Zealand on a business trip, that's a separate issue, I took the opportunity to do one of the tour guides through Cook Strait. And the tour guide was fantastic and deeply interested in New Zealand history and the history of how it was created from the British arrival and how the local people were dealt with subsequently. And I just happened to ask him in a question, do you see that island there in the middle of Cook Strait? Probably the biggest island in the entire map of New Zealand, called Patton Island. And I said to him, do you know that's called after a Dublin man? And he said, no, I didn't know that. That's very interesting. But it really doesn't matter. It was more back to Captain Cook. And that sank into my mind. What was our role in all of this? Angela's reference to it was brief, but with a massive role. And should we want to remain blind to some of the involvement of the Irish in all of this? I mean, we know, reading the paper, taking down statues, renaming parts of Dublin City, a movement to try to even rename Berkeley and Trinity College because of all this empire. So that's my question. We'll be as well off to stay undercover in all of this question.
British Navy has been mentioned here, right? I mean, and just to put this in context, I mean, half of Britain's military establishment, this is land-based troops, was based in Ireland. And usually that's been put down to the need to you know, police the country, right? But at a previous head school we did on the Ireland, the Empire and the Sea, it was pointed out that it was also because that's where the manpower was, that's where the resources were. It was also pointed out that although it was illegal for Catholics to bear arms and therefore join the armed forces, whether Navy or Army, Catholics were recruited anyway, but they could only be recruited if they were shipped out immediately to somewhere else. In other words, there's a direct relationship between the large size of the military establishment and the Navy. So how would you quantify Irish involvement in say, the Royal Navy?
Well, I'll go back to the Roman Empire first. So how empires work, and Romans did it perfectly. If you go to Hadrian's Wall in the border between Scotland and England, you don't find many Romans or Italians up there. What you'll find is Romanians, you'll find people from Persia, you'll find from people from all over the Mediterranean world. Because when you're running an empire, you don't go to these places yourself. You send the other countries that you've subjugated and you send them off.
The Aztecs are the same.
Exactly, yes, yeah. Exact same. So how the British Empire worked, and this kind of ties in with your comments about New Zealand and elsewhere, is that the Irish, up to 1793, there was a ban on Roman Catholics joining, but prior to that there was a blind eye. But it was all about, and even after 1793, of taking Irish sailors and soldiers and bringing them around the rest of the world. So the Irish are sent to India to keep an eye on the Indian Empire. The Scottish are sent over to keep an eye on us here. And again, in a given year, you were looking at 30,000 British troops in Ireland keeping an eye on us, and then an equal sized number of Irishmen being sent around the world. And that's how the empire worked. And you did similar with the sailors. And again, when it comes to sailing, you have to remember that the Royal Navy isn't at its peak continuously. It's only kind of ramps up and is getting near to a war. And that's when you have the press gangs and the kind of mass recruitment that you need. But the army is kind of continuous recruitment throughout the 1700s and the 1800s. The American War Revolution is kind of essential because the Irish are heavily involved in that. But again, this overcoming, this blind eye they've shown to Roman Catholic recruits into the British Army to fight against the colonials is huge. And again, it's there's only research being done out at the moment that we can kind of quantify the numbers. When the British Army, the kind of first census in 1830 of it, you're looking at 40% of the British Army is Irish. And then if you're looking at the Royal Navy at Trafalgar, it's calculated about a quarter of the sailors at Trafalgar are Irish-born. Sadly, for Cork people, they're not all from Cork. So you would think that Cork, with its long kind of navy tradition, that would be coming from the southeast. The largest proportion of people are actually coming from Dublin. So at Trafalgar, there are 1,000 Dubs at Trafalgar. But you also then have all the coastal villages all around the island are providing into the Royal Navy. And that tradition carries on throughout the 1800s. And then in the 1860s, you have something called the Royal Naval Reserve established. And that tradition of dockers or sailors or merchant seamen, people working in harbours and ports around the country, had a tradition of being on the Naval Reserve and would get a bounty each year to be on that. And it was a grand way of getting a bit of extra cash, and hopefully there'd be no wars. And for most of the 1800s, the Royal Navy had a very quiet period. What they did was they went on explorations. That's what the Royal Navy did, because it wasn't fighting major wars. And that was the whole way right up into World War One. There's a long answer for you.
Yeah, now, the thing is, when I was doing research, my research area was the United Irishmen in the 1790s. Mm-hmm. And I have a figure in my head that in the 1790s, like 60% of naval ratings were Irish. I mean, could that be true?
It could.
And I assume the reason for that is a lot of these were either United Irishmen or white boys who'd been shipped, who'd been basically arrested without any trial and shipped off into the Navy. And this brings me, Lara, to the whole question of press gangs. Mm-hmm. So I assume that if a Royal Navy mast appeared in the bay, everyone scarpered, because a press gang was in town. But it was a little bit more complicated than that, wasn't it?
The press gangs are tied up with wars. So if the Navy needs a huge recruitment drive, that's when you start to see press gangs being introduced. There's an act that allows them to go into the dockland areas of cities looking for people. But they're looking for professionals. They're looking for sailors who have come off merchant ships and try to press them into service. So the idea that they're just grabbing any kind of available mail, it does happen. What they wanted and what they were looking for were kind of sailors who were well-tanned, looked like they worked on a ship, they're the kind of people who are going to be nabbed. And if you go into the Fremont's Journal, on kind of, which is available online, you can actually see, you know, there's kind of incidences of press gangs taking up to 100 people in the 1793 in November. So kind of 100 men taking up around the Docklands area, Suraj and Ski, and brought on to ships. But at the same time, you see locals then having riots and you know, press gangs being attacked by locals because, again, families don't want to see their families, their husbands or brothers being taken away from them. So there is that kind of tension when it comes to press gangs.
But you're saying then that they'd pick up somebody who looked like a sailor. So you're talking about vocational profiling here, right?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So, I mean, did it have a tattoo saying, I am a sailor, right? Or, I mean, it's fairly subjective.
Yes, somebody who's weathered and well-tanned and looked like they'd been at sea for about 6 months would, I think, probably stick out.
Mike, would Michael here be picked up if he was spotted, you know? I mean, the tan is gone, though.
Be hiding in the background. Yeah. Tan's all worn off, been here for the last 8 years now.
Yeah, another question on the floor there.
The interesting thing about all this is the whole business of prize money.
Yes, I was going to come to that. Yeah. I should go on,
No, you look at it like this. If you're on a massive big man of war, in effect, all you're doing is eating 3 meals a day and fighting the odd battle. You're not nippy. You're not going after the merchantmen. You're not going after the stuff that is valuable cargoes. So you would have certain captains kind of in frigates and in the smaller jobs. They would have a good reputation, kind of, we'd say, for making money. And they would put notices in shop windows because the idea would have been in the Royal Navy, that the sailors got a raw deal. They were heroes during the war, and then they were on the street. And basically, kind of what that meant, as Lars said, massive big recruitment drives in a hurry. But some were more susceptible than others, because if you had a lucky captain, Bligh was regarded as a lucky captain, because Bligh got his blokes home. You know, and he's much maligned in the movies, but he got his blokes home. But Bligh was different, though. Bligh was a poor man's son, because Bligh's old dad was in the customs in Plymouth. He wasn't some big burke kind of in a landed estate. Didn't really matter kind of if there was a peace or war. But I suppose the point you're making kind of in terms of the naval ports and any ports, the various press gangs, and they had a situation called a rendezvous. And a rendezvous was a lockup where basically the guys were put in there until, for the most part, the South of Ireland guys went to Plymouth. And then they were integrated into the fleet. And there's some interesting stuff done on this, but this is actually what I'm coming on to, this idea of sea blindness, that this is actually where the research is done. And it is like a combination of research. It goes into politics, it goes into economics, and it also goes into ships handling. Thank you.
Yeah, just chap there behind you.
Sorry, just 2 points and a question. I think the McGarrels were the largest recipients of the McGarrels from Antrim, the largest recipients of compensation in the Slave Compensation Act, I think.
Right? Name doesn't ring a bell, but geographically you're right.
I thought Gladstone's father was the largest individual person who was that's just a point. And if you want to find out where Irish people, the Legacies of British Slavery database at UCL has all the addresses. If anybody wants to Google that, it's real easy to work with. But my question is about food. And I suppose, you know, Cork is known for its food exports to the plantations. And have you much information on food exported from Dublin Port to the same places?
The big kind of thing we take... One decent listing we have is from 1785. It's linen that's been actually exported from Dublin in very large amounts to the plantations and to Europe also. I don't see a huge amount of food stuff going out, actually, from the listings when I looked at it this morning. So it was products who were being sent out. And again, you're right, Cork is huge. And, of course, Cork providing heavily to the Royal Navy. That's the other thing that's providing with the butter.
Just on a point with regard to press gangs... Jonas Hanway set up the Marine Society in 1756 in order to stop and circumvent the press ganging that was happening within the tidal area of London and London Port. The Marine Society is actually one of the oldest maritime welfare relief charities still in existence today. And it evolved from trying to circumvent press gangs because a lot of merchant navy seafarers were being stolen and put into the Royal Navy, and therefore the merchants in the coffee houses in London could not find their crew when they needed them to go to sea. They went from press ganging and trying to stop that to now working with seafarers who are still at sea or willing to come from sea to shore in terms of education and free access to education resources while they're at sea, and then when they want to retrain to come into a role within the merchant trade in the City of London or in other ports, because those skills that you develop at sea as a seafarer are also very important when you are looking at people working in marine insurance, within ship broking, within trading, and also working in ports.
Okay, now I just want to just go re-pivot things slightly here, because we've already come across these larger-than-life characters, whether it be Captain Cook or Captain Bligh or whatever. But Angela, what about maritime history from the bottom up, if you like, the people down the food chain?
Yeah, as has already been mentioned a few times, the Royal Navy was a massive employer for Irish people, and of course the vast majority of them are way down the ranks. And then the other people who are often very absent from the histories of life at sea are women. And I've done a fair bit of work on first-person narratives of voyages, shipboard narratives, people's memoirs, emigrant correspondence, that sort of thing. And that's kind of a body of sources where you have such rich diversity in terms of being able to tap into women's lives at sea. So one that I've worked on recently was The Letters of Sarah Curran, and a lot of you will know her as Robert Emmett's girlfriend, but she was so much more than that, and I've published a couple of articles to demonstrate that. But her letters of when she and her new husband, Henry Sturgeon, are heading to Sicily, because he's stationed there with the British Army during the Napoleonic Wars, and she writes, passing through the Strait of Gibraltar in big letters at the top of a page, triple underlined, Africa. And she imagines being able to see the Bedouin and the camels on the slopes of the Atlas Mountains. It's, of course, all in her mind's eye, in her imagination, but as she sails past. And then, of course, coming home about a year and a half later, she goes into early labour when they're being returned to England, delivers her baby boy on board ship in the English Channel during a dreadful storm. I think she actually might have been induced by the storm. It was so terrible. And prematurely delivers her little boy. And it's the most devastating set of correspondence to read. But she's often just looked at in light of Robert Emmett's girlfriend, but there's so much more. And what I'm trying to say with that example is that the life at sea, and in some ways, like, I think this is nearly all what we're working towards with everything we're saying here, is the sea is everywhere in Irish history and Irish culture. And in some ways, the ubiquity is nearly what makes it hardest to pick it out. So I've worked so much on women's correspondence, women's journals, unpublished letters and diaries from the 18th and 19th centuries. And the sea comes into it all the time, because people are travelling, people are emigrating, people are heading off to the continent to get the cure at the spa villages and spa towns. And the voyage by sea is always part, it has to be part of leaving this island. So it's everywhere, and
Is this another negative association, the association with emigration, which is obviously is a melancholy thing?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it often
another,
is, yeah.
Another reason for sea blindness.
Yeah, and emigration often is a melancholy thing, and we know about the Bridget Hears and Donegal and all the emigrant ballads and all the rest of it, but emigration is also often a very positive thing. And just to give one example of how you can look at that, my own great-great-grandmother, Rose Brogan, emigrated from Donegal in 1893. And when I looked at the manifest of the ship she sailed on, it was called the City of Rome. It left Derry via Mobile for North America in 1893 in August. The vast majority, it's something like 70%. I have the manifest in my bag if anyone wants to see it. The vast majority of people on that board were like her. They were unmarried, young women who were servants. And I can't, like, they would have had a wee cry, I'm sure, when they got on board the ship, and they would have had the first bit of getting to know each other. There is no way in the hull of that ship there wasn't singing, gossip, games, fun. You cannot imagine that number of young Irish women being in one place and there not being a bit of crack after a few days and the initial shock of that wrench from your loved ones has gone. I just cannot picture that life any other way. So, like, emigration's often negative, but there's the positive as well. Like, the coffin ships is something in the popular mind that people would associate with life at sea and emigration. Most people think coffin ships. The coffin ships are about 2 years during the worst of the famine. The rest of the time, Houston and Smith said it in their magisterial study of the Irish emigration to Canada. They said that Irish emigrant experiences across the Atlantic are characterized by successful outcomes and uneventful journeys. I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that. And that is, again, I think, part of the reason why this stuff hadn't been studied as much. People are more attracted by the narrative of the mutiny on the Bounty or the more exciting tales of John Crean or whoever. The other stuff, life aboard ship, you know, and I know my brother's a marine engineer and we've a lot of maritime in the family. Life aboard ship is regimented. Right? And that's not as exciting. So I was looking recently at a ship surgeon diary from the 1840s, a ship surgeon who was accompanying convicts to the penal colonies. And I was like, I can't wait to get my hands on this diary. This is going to be amazing. And I got it. I was so excited, ripped it open. It was one of the dullest manuscripts I've ever read.
Can you make a contribution here, Michael? I mean, is life at sea dead boring, like, in fact? Like,
I don't mean to say all the time.
As it's made out to be.
We used to joke that on some of the longer voyages in particular, that it was 95% boredom, and then when you get into port, it was 5% panic. Because the idea was to get in and out of port as quick as possible. That's what the owner wanted, get the cargo on and off, and get the ship back transporting goods, which is what it's paid to do. And in fact, even when COVID came around then, an awful lot of the talk among the seafarer communities ashore and down in the harbour office, everybody in the world giving out about having to go back home to their house and all the rest. And we were very much like, oh, it's just like a voyage at sea now. We go back home, we have our dinner, go to bed, we get up the next morning, we go to work, and there's nothing else. It wasn't that mad variety to every day that we get the joy of here in the centre of Dublin.
Now, can I just go back to you, because you mentioned, talking about Dublin and Dublin Port, right, that there was an expanding economy in the 18th century, lots of shipping in and out of the port. Now, does that change after the Act of Union?
The Act of Union, yeah. So what you start to see is a bigger trade to Liverpool. So we're essentially appendage to Liverpool. Liverpool is the biggest port in the UK at the time. By the 20th century, it's something like has 50,000 dockers, so it's kind of it's a huge place. So what you're seeing is ships from around the world coming into to Liverpool. The ship's loads are being broken down and then brought over to Dublin.
So in a sense, that view of Ireland looking out in the world, right, you know, contracts. And then we're just looking across to Liverpool, essentially.
Which is the point that Angela made. I mean, once you get the rail network, these smaller kind of towns that had access to water become less economically, it's just not profitable to have ships going there. So once the railway network is established, it's coming to Cork. Rosslare is established in 1905. And again, it's built onto the rail network. And it's all about the rail network bringing you to the ports as quickly as possible. And then you're going to be, going to the bigger ships. So again, those big ships can't come into Dublin and they can't come into Cork. But people are going to go to Liverpool, which is a more frequent service, and that's where you're going to go.
Does that affect Cork as well, though? Or does it continue to trade with the rest of the world?
No, I mean, quite recently, Dublin now is kind of the biggest port in the country. But Cork, right up into the 1970s, was a booming and busier port.
And it was busier?
Yeah. I mean, right. If you were kind of gambling in the early 1970s about the future of Dublin Port, and when Cork was the biggest port at the time, it's kind of gone, because I mean, it's essentially about size and sense. For logistics, people coming to, everything's pushed into Dublin to get here as quickly as possible. And that's what happened in the 70s and 80s, that Dublin becomes a bigger and bigger city, and that's why the port gets bigger.
Now, of course, the sea plays a big role in the revolutionary period, Lar. Mm-hmm. Just talk to us about that.
Well, so, I mean, the most famous one is, of course, in 1914, in the summer of 1914, is the Asgard, the famous smuggling of the 900 rifles into into the whole a secret operation, which is the most photographed secret operation ever to happen. I mean, it's an amazing piece of yachtsmanship for Childers. The fact that he arrived exactly on time, the ship was unloaded, the photographers are there to greet them. And it was a big moment in Irish nationalist history, because previously they've been humiliated by the fact that the UVF, the Ulster Volunteer Force, had smuggled in 30,000 rifles. So the nationalists were never going to achieve that. So that's kind of the one key moment. that kind of is significant. But of course, the failure of the 1916 Rising, when we look at the failure of the 1916 Rising, we focus on, you know, what happened in Dublin. But the reason why the 1916 Rising fails is because the secret ship, the Aud, is captured. And once the 20,000 Russian rifles are captured, that's it, game over.
So it's lost at sea?
It's lost at sea. Well, no, what happens is that it's captured in Kerry, and as the Aud has been brought back into Cork, the ship's captain stops the ship, everyone goes into the lifeboats, they put on their German uniforms at that stage, and the ship is sunk. But prior to that, once it's captured, and Casement is captured, a short time afterwards, the revolution in many ways is over, because you can't fight a revolution with 900 rifles that you brought in through Howth. And that's a kind of a big impact on the 1916 Rising, which again is going back to sea blindness, is kind of forgotten. It's, oh, the Aud was captured and then the revolution started, but it's the failure of the Aud arriving, yeah. The 20,000 rifles. If the 20,000 rifles had arrived, then you would have had people rising up because there was weapons to fight with. The reason why, you know, with the kind of the call-up and then the cancellation of the call-up is that there isn't enough equipment to fight a revolution.
And of course, a battleship shells rebels and County Galway, off the coast of Galway.
Galway is firing in Galway. The famous Helga, which is a Department of Agriculture patrol ship, is brought into fire in Dublin. The Helga itself is just built 200 metres away in Dublin Port in 1907. It's a Department of Agriculture ship, a fishery protection ship and a scientific ship. And it's impressed into service in just during the war by the Royal Navy as an auxiliary ship. And it kind of shows you in many ways that the Royal Navy doesn't have its best ships in Dublin or on the east coast of Ireland. The best ships are in Scotland, in Scapa Flow. What you have here is armoured trawlers, armed fishery protection ships like the Helga, and a small older ships out in Dunleary. And they're used, they're the first response to the 1916 Rising and the bombardment then by the Helga. But you have to remember the crew mutinied. They were not, there were civilians, there were civil servants who had been told to kind of join the Royal Navy and then been told to fire in Dublin. It wasn't exactly what they signed up for in 1916.
Now, if the 1916 Rising was lost on the sea, mm-hmm. The Civil War was won by the pro-treaty side on the sea.
Again, you know, participation by the Royal Navy, the Coast Guard in during the War of Independence, there isn't much impact. The only time the Royal Navy is really used is to ship out POWs, IRA captured prisoners out of Ireland. Coast Guard headquarters or buildings are attacked during the War of Independence. But you're right, during the Civil War, this masterful move by the Free State, and it broke the Civil War for the anti-treaty forces simply by bringing the Free State troops down to Cork, to Patches West, also to Clifton, to Westport, using the sea and doing it very, very quickly. But again, under the treaty, there's a ban on the new Free State of creating its own navy force. It's supposed to be later on in the 1920s, a subsequent agreement, and it never happens. And there isn't a naval service established onto the emergency. But it is at one moment for kind of a three-month period of the summer of 1923 or 1922, where, you know, by moving the using ships, the Free State forces are able to outmaneuver the anti-treaty forces quite spectacularly.
Okay, I'm just getting a look at the time here. I just want to move things up into the closer to our present time. Mike, I want to come to the whole issue of containerization. I presume this was a major game changer.
Of course, and Dublin as much as everywhere else, and you know, those thousands of dockers that used to be at the morning call waiting for their name to be called out for work, that all changed really quickly and somewhat. You know, we look at containers now, it's not really as romantic as dock work used to be, and we've no idea. We know what's in the containers, but they all just look the same. And, you know, it also, I think it refers to, you know, the globalization of shipping, and we talked earlier about Irish Shipping, and you know the failure of that company or the closing down of the company. You know, for an island nation to have a shipping company would go against what's happened with globalization. So if we pick a ship that's been in the news recently, the one that hit the bridge in Maryland, for example, right? That ship is owned by a company. It was chartered by another company. Okay, it was manned and operated by another company.
Okay.
It was crewed by another company, classified for all the technical regulations by another company. And then there are a number of companies who come together to try and ensure it. So it's a very different world in that respect. Mm. And to have that resilience as an island nation would be, I suppose, hugely costly. you know, and would go against some of those chains. Not that it's not the right thing to do, but that's, you know, just the facts of it, you know. So it has changed vastly over the last number of decades with that.
Now, this obviously led to a huge slimming down of the workforce, Angela, right? And this is another, you know, reason for sea blindness, it would seem to me. There are less people working in shipping. There's less stories to tell, you know, stuff being, you know, folklore being passed along. So there's a folklore deficit.
Yeah, shipping and the fisheries as well. Like, I'm from Donegal, you may have guessed. I mean, communities in places like Inishowen and southwest Donegal feel absolutely and completely forgotten. But just thinking about the folklore bit, I did do a search this morning before coming, and if you just type the word fishing into the treasure trove that is the Dukas collection online, you'll get 2,441 results of pieces of folklore that were passed by children onto their teachers 90 years ago. So, you know, 2,500 results for fishing, that's an absolute treasure trove. And I brought his picture, but I won't show you, you won't be able to see. An ancestor of mine is in there. He was actually a kind of a fixer in the small, little, tiny little fishing port that now is home to, you know, something like 4 or 6 little fishing boats. But he was a bit of a fixer in the first half of the 20th century for the bigger vessels that would have docked in Culdaff Bay, which is a deep water bay in Inishowen. Now nobody knows about it except people who go for beach holidays. But he passed on folklore about great feats that were performed at the beach, the games and the pastimes that were associated with that maritime space on the pier. That's all been completely forgotten. There was a tradition of holding raft races in some of these places to raise money for charity and stuff. But all that thriving social and cultural life that revolved around ports and piers, big and small around the country, is almost completely gone. And I think one of our biggest resources for trying to get back in touch with that richness and the way people engaged with the space as a public space, like we're seeing more and more now, not to draw on about Ballyshannon, but the creation of what's now a playground and a kind of a children's recreational space where they dumped all the construction waste from the creation of the Erin hydroelectric plant. And there's now €500,000 going into creating a more kind of, you know, outward looking heritage focused space for tourism, crafts and community engagement. But it's also slow and so piecemeal. And it feels like there needs to be something more akin to like a national strategy for those public spaces that embody our maritime heritage and places that have industrial architecture or other kind of built fabric that's associated with our rich maritime and fishing industries.
Just a couple of comments on the sea during the revolutionary decade. There were two successful gun running episodes by sea during the War of Independence and before the Civil War, one in November 1921 and one in March 1922, the first into Waterford Harbour, the second into Binding Owl and Ring. And that was from Germany with a significant amount of arms. And although the treaty prohibited the establishment of a navy in Ireland, it did allow for vessels to control, to protect fishing, to police fishing, and to protect revenue. And Michael Collins initially set up what was called the Coastal and Marine Protection Service, used during the Civil War, and it had 19 armed vessels. Wow. It was arguably our first navy. It lasted about 16 months before the government disbanded it. However, that's, you know, that's perhaps part of the sea blindness. But did the demise of Irish shipping, who used to have this wonderful thing for the schools, track the fleet around that? And I remember it well. And I remember ships like the Irish Oak, etc., the Irish Pine, coming into Waterford. And how you were proud of these as Irish ships. And did that contribute, if you like, to the sea blindness, the demise of Irish shipping?
No, I mean, there's definitely a kind of golden era, if you like, from the emergency to the 1980s, where there is this understanding that we're an island nation. And the Maritime Museum and the Maritime Inscription, we're kind of, there is this kind of, you know, at a very national level that this is important. And I think you're right. I think after the 1980s, it becomes less important. The reality is today that people fly off the island, so Dublin Airport gets, what, 35 million people, we get 1.6 million leaving here. So there is a kind of a disconnect leaving the island now. But the death of, or the ending of the Irish shipping, I think, yeah, kind of lost that. And again, it comes back to Michael's comment that, you know, about containerization. The ships that they had were freighters based on a design in the 1950s. So they would take everything from bulk, from, you know, food, there could be a car on board. And it was very complicated to load these ships. So these ships could kind of take 10 days to load up in New York to come back to Ireland. And of course, containerization just did away with that. And the challenge for Irish shipping then and for the Irish state as they went into the recession in the 70s and 80s and the cost of fuel was to modernize a fleet of container ships, which is where the world was changing. And sadly, Irish shipping kind of lost out to that and wasn't replaced.
No, just you mentioned air travel. I mean, we're drawing up a list of villains here. We've identified the British Empire. we might add the Catholic Church to it, like for having fish on a Friday, like, which put people off eating fish. But maybe we should add Michael O'Leary to the list, you know, the dominance of Ryanair. I know, but really seriously, the point is a massive public profile. Yeah. And it's now, is it the biggest carrier in the world now? You know, and you know, but the contrast between that and appreciation of the sea is striking, you know.
When I was a kid, like, if you wanted to go over to see family in England, you went on a ferry.
Yeah.
My kids have never been on a ferry. So that's just reality. The easy option is to hop on a plane and leave the island. And I do think there is that kind of disconnect. Unless you come to the port, or if you go to Rosslare, or if you go to Cork, you kind of see how busy it can be. But even, I don't know, Michael might have commented, but even when you're down at Terminal 1 and 2 here, seeing the ships going to Holyhead, it seems always to be English-registered cars rather than Irish-registered cars, or maybe.
Indeed, and the last time there was massive queues for the ferries was when the, remember the Icelandic volcano? And there was hundreds of people queuing around the corners then to try and get their travel done via sea, all wondering, where's the smell of the cattle gone? Because they hadn't been on a ferry since indeed those times.
Yeah,
because they'd been on jet planes, yeah.
Michael, just because we're nearly coming to the end here, right, I just want to maybe talk a bit about Dublin Port today. Like, I mean, like, just talk to us, give us a few figures, like, I mean, how much trade does it handle, like, for the country?
So over, or between 50% and 60% of the country's trade comes in through Dublin Port and up our navigation channel, which of course is critical national infrastructure. That links very well into the Dublin Tunnel, just here 600 metres away, and straight onto the M50 motorway network. So it's a very good route to market system, I suppose. To deliver all those goods, and most of them are containers and trucks. So you think of everything that's in here, the steel, the windows, the clothes we're wearing, the stage, the electronics in our pocket, everything that you saw in the Blanchardstown Shopping Centre, Dundrum, the Pavilion Shopping Centre, the last time you were there, likely come in a box in through Dublin Port. So over 82% of all the country's boxes come in through Dublin Port, and over 35% of Ireland's energy needs. But that takes about 50 ships a day. An average day is 46 ships. And today, my phone's beeping away here, the team down in the harbour office are very busy on a day like today. There was a car carrier made it in this morning before the wind got too bad, and there's cars discharging into the staging area to go off to the Nace Road and all those places in the coming days. So about 46 to 50 ship movements a day up and down that channel. So extraordinarily busy.
Now, one of the problems is, though, if you're a resident in this city, physically, you're hardly aware of support out there. Right, so this comes to my, you know, my concluding question. Right, should we shift the whole thing off somewhere else?
Well, I have an awful lot to say on that. Actually, keep everybody here for a while. But
They did it in Barcelona very successfully, for example. Anyway, take the floor there, Michael, on that one.
I suppose the first thing that jumps out when you say people aren't aware of what goes in the port. So Lars' function in particular in Dublin Port is doing a massive amount of work to realise that the port-city integration that can take place, and hopefully everybody saw the publicity last week that we got for the Greenway, the Talca Estuary Greenway, overlooking Clontarf up to the north behind us there. And even as I drove in, coming in here this afternoon, my daughter's in the corner there, we were a little bit early, went for a spin down along, and there was families walking out for a bracing Sunday walk this afternoon to come into the port, see the port on one side, see the Talca Estuary on the other. And much like our lovely gates here, which are open all week to allow people come into the Maritime Garden here and across the distributed museum network that Lara and the teams have put together from the diving bell up in Sir John Rogerson's Quay and further down into the port.
But I'll let Lara talk about that. You have to answer my question, though. Should we?
You're on the Mr. MacWilliams. Yes, that's what he wants. He wants to know all that. Well, we do tours of the port very regularly, and oftentimes we use the St. Bridget, which is the tour vessel that goes over to Dunleary and Howth. And there is never a tour that takes place that people don't leave thinking to themselves, yes, paper doesn't refuse ink, because it's easy to write that article every 6 months and challenge, you know, no problem with challenge. But when we look at the critical national infrastructure that's here, the access to deep water, which you've touched on a number of times, and that challenge of 300 years ago when they were seeking depth, as you put it, lovely term, we've still sought depth over the previous years here and gone from 7.8 metres to 10 metres in our channel.
So you just remind Michael that there was a proposal at one stage to move the harbour to Dalkey, which is exactly where David MacWilliams lives today.
Yes. So if we look at the Irish coastline, and we've talked here about sandbars, and on that Irish coast programme, you'll see lots of commentary about the difference between the West Coast and East Coast, the West Coast being all cliffs, of course. East Coast is all sand, and it's all shallow. So Dublin is hidden inside Dublin Bay, isn't it? We're in the inside of this lovely U, and that beach from Dalkey all the way around to Howth, you know, we're spoiled. And Dublin Port is in the centre of it, with access to deep water from the river. If the port was to be moved to Arklow or to Braemore, and we've done all the work, there's a load of interesting papers on our website, actually, post-2040 papers it's referred to. The first thing you would have to do, like we talked about building those walls, the first thing you would have to do is build massive breakwater structures out into the Irish Sea, right in the middle of areas that are protected under the EU Habitats Directive. So we don't think you'd ever get planning permission for that. Now, that would cost billions, and that's before you start to build the port infrastructure inside. So, in fact, if anybody gets the opportunity to look at those papers, the port at Braemore would be larger than the town and surrounding area of Drogheda, stuck out into the middle of the Irish Sea. And similarly, down at Arklow, it would be larger than Arklow and the suburbia around it.
Yeah.
So moving the port, moving the waste-to-energy plant, the water treatment plant, the four power stations, the two ferry terminals, the three low-low terminals.
We've priced it, Michael, you've convinced me.
We priced it a number of years ago at about $12 billion, so I don't think even nowadays the Apple money would pay for it.
Right.
You know.
Now, so tell us all this good work you're doing that Michael's telling us you've been doing.
Well, no, just to explain this building. So this is the substation. It's part of our distributed museum network. So as you can see in the glass floor there is the east wall. So we're preserving bits and pieces of our heritage. We have a diving bell museum, which is on Sarajan's Quay, which, as Michael mentioned earlier on, talks about the rebuilding of the quay walls in the 1800s. And we also have 200 metres away from here, and I'd encourage you to go down, is the pump house area, which is an area that we've, at the moment, has been curated by the Temple Bar Galleries as the old shipbuilding part of the port, but it's an area that we've gone and preserved the industrialisation. And then the exhibition that you see around you here on the walls here is an exhibition by an artist called Fergal McCarthy, who's created this lovely 9 metre long map of all the bridges in Dublin. So the port had responsibility for all the bridges from 1811 to 1977. And that's why there's so few bridges in Dublin, because Dublin City would say, Dublin Port, we want bridges. And the port would say, no, we don't have any money. We don't want to build bridges. Since 1977, I think more bridges have been built by Dublin Corporation than the port ever did in 100 years. And that was kind of, you know, the kind of the maritime city that we were, that the quay walls, the bridges, all the way up to Euston Station were the responsibility of the port, as well as Michael saying, the bay and the walls and everything else to keep the port open. So that kind of story, what we're trying to do is kind of explain that story and bring people down here. And then, as Michael said, we opened up a greenway on Thursday, and Tommy was there. And if you want to go for a 2.6 kilometre run, our cycle, it's there. I wouldn't go today. It's too wet and windy. But it does give you new views of the port area, but also particular spectacular views of Clontarf, the Tolka estuary, which again is a nature reserve. That's why the port can't expand, because for many years there were plans to fill in Tolka estuary. And it can't, because as Michael says, we're now surrounded by these European designated nature reserves. So what the port is doing at the moment is trying to improve the capacity that it has, and the same by 2040 it'll probably reach its limit. And then at the same time, trying to get people to come down here and see the port and maybe move away from some of this sea blindness that Joe and others were talking about, and actually see the port as that we're an island nation. In many ways, just to kind of finish up, just coming back to the bridges, the reason why I think in Dublin we've lost that sense is because of the Loop Line Bridge, which is the railway bridge that was built in the 1890s. That bridge, if you were standing on a Con Street before 1890, you had a vista of the bay. you had this beautiful, you had this beautiful custom house building, you had this beautiful vista down, and then that bridge is kind of cut us off. And even in the, as a city, I think we've lost that link with the water and the sea.
In fact, it's so ugly, it doesn't even have a name.
No, it's just called the Loop Line Bridge,
right? But it's not named after anybody.
So we started with sea blindness, but that bridge cuts us off from our water and from our sea and from our port. So.
Okay, if there's anybody else who hasn't contributed before, if you want to come in, just because we're going to wrap up now shortly. Yeah.
Just two things very quickly. My husband just picked out the name Erasmus Smith. Is that it? Yeah. And we had come across it before because he endowed the high school, and our son went there, and we found out the next day that it was endowed by a slave owner. Yeah. And just another thing, I'm kind of disappointed there's been nothing about fisheries. And I hear an awful lot. I'm listening to on Salo Yas on Radio Nageithota, and there's an awful lot about fisheries there, and such a heartbreaking story, you know. And we're totally forgetting. There are no votes in it so politicians completely ignore it. Absolutely no votes. There's votes for, you know, for new roads and whatnot, but nothing for that. Okay. And heaps else as well. You know, there's a very good man down there in the aquarium place in Dingle. Thank you. And O'Flannery is his name, Kevin O'Flannery. He's really fantastic on it all. And super interesting as well on the EU and what has been going on and what has been ignored by Ireland. And will I go on for another second?
Yep.
I think it was when the war started with where did it start? Russia. Ukraine. Okay. So there was a shortage of oil for Europe. They were going to get it from Norway. And I heard O'Flannery talking about this one day, and I was getting an Irish Times every day at that time, and there was no mention about this on it. But so Europe was going to go to Norway and was going to get oil there, and they were going to give some part of Irish fishery to Norway. And it would have just happened without anybody noticing, but one Irish voice over in Europe happened to notice it, and I never heard what happened afterwards, and it never appeared on the Irish Times, so I don't know if Norway got it, if they got the oil, but no mention. It's of no interest to anybody. And the saddest thing is, you know, that families, all the knowledge of places where they used to fish and so on, a lot of knowledge is being lost, and they're having to sell their boats, and they're becoming tour guides, you know, instead. It's ridiculous. It's terrible.
Do you want to comment on that, Angela? On the fisheries question?
Certainly the fishing communities are, you asked me earlier on, Laura, about marginalised people in the history, maritime history, but the fishing communities are the people marginalised in the maritime story today. And they just happen to come from predominantly the lower earning parts of the country, like Inishowen and some of the other coastal communities, Gaeltacht communities as well, and just places where the voices aren't heard as much. And I would have joined, along with my brother, some of the marches as well that were organised by groups like the Killybegs Fisheries Organisations and that 20 years ago, and nobody was really listening. Pardon? Killybegs is doing okay. For anybody who can't hear in the recording, the questioner is just saying Killybegs is doing well. Killybegs is doing okay. I would say, as somebody from South Donegal, cruise ships are landing in Killybegs in small numbers, but they're putting those people on buses and bringing them to Derry to go shopping. And again, there's no vista of, we've got these people in one of, you know, a heritage port town that has been working for hundreds of years as a port, and instead of keeping them there and using it as an opportunity to discuss our maritime history and, you know, Gaeltacht areas and Irish culture and all the rest, we'll just bring these people shopping. So there's a bigger job work to be done, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that the sea is everywhere, and especially if you're in the regions in Ireland. But I think also in places like the working class communities in North Inner City, the folklore heritage in neighbourhoods like this, when it comes to maritime, fishery and port life, is absolutely enormous. And there nearly needs to be a strategy, you know, nearly like what we're seeing for women's history now with the scoping exercise for what's in the national cultural institutions. There nearly needs to be the same for maritime history.
Thank you. I think just apropos what you've just been talking about now, and perhaps what has happened in my lifetime, which is a reflection of where we are now, I would say that, yeah, from the 1980s, it's the disappearance of everything from view that really causes a huge amount of issues. You have places all around the country where, for example, fishing has disappeared and the industries have disappeared within the country. Our manufacturing base had disappeared. What we export had disappeared largely. The Guinness barges disappeared. It was the visual reminder every day that what came into and went out of this country, including people, happened by sea largely. And then, of course, Mr. O'Leary takes us all away for other reasons. But I think what has really happened is that even containerization, for example, which visually abstracts you, there's an isolation between what is actually happening and what our daily lives are about. We go into a shop, we see something, it comes from Taiwan, it comes from wherever it comes from. It doesn't matter. We have no idea how it got here and we don't question that at all because we have no engagement with the process any longer. And I think the opening up of that process through the opening up of the port, for example, is one of the ways that we can perhaps rescue a lot of that folklore and that oral tradition and interest people in the writings again, in being educated about this within our country. But I think it really comes down to the idea that we must have some experiential relationship to it. And it's reinvigorating that I think this is a very important part of that engagement and that absolutely superb museum in Dunleary, by the way.
We just take one more before we wrap up.
Just one quick question. Does the port have the capacity to support the vessels that will be needed to put in wind industry infrastructure? You know, if the Doggy Warriors are beaten and they're built, the wind farm is built out there, is there the risk that will have to be serviced from the UK?
I'll take that, yeah. Certainly with the capacity levels we're at Dublin Port at the moment, we're up over 90% with cargo demands at the moment. So we're all aware of the size and scale of those wind farms. So we certainly don't have the quay wall space for them to be shipped out from Dublin Port and with those large construction bases. So it will be done from other Irish ports in competition for that sort of business. I know, Rosslare and even up in Belfast, Belfast are already engaged in that. And then some of the smaller ports are in competition, for example, Arklow, Wicklow, for the ongoing service and maintenance once the construction is finished. So there is hopefully local boosts there and opportunities for youngsters to get qualified in and starting out at those, I was going to say ground levels, sea levels of qualifications to get them up the ladder of sea careers, hopefully.
Do you want to add in before you? Lara.
Just before we finish up, just to say over in the corner there you'll find some of our yearbooks which kind of detail about everything that we're doing in relation to port system integration, but also a large amount of what the work that Michael supervises and gives you an idea of kind of the scale of the operation. And please do take one if you want one. Just send an email if there aren't enough, or if you want more, just send an email to the archive email address and I'm happy to send one out to you. The other one is that we do, Mike and myself, do regular tours around the port when we have time. We're busy a lot of the time, but we do bus tours and occasionally do boat tours on the water. So do keep an eye out for those. I want to be on our socials, but it's well worth it. If you want to contact us, we'll put you on our list. But if you want to get into the active port, you kind of see how busy the place is and get you an idea of what it looks like.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up there. Now, our next Dublin History Festival event, Our Man in Moscow, an interview with former diplomat Jim Sharkey, who opened the Irish Embassy in Moscow in 1974. That'll be in the back room of the Cobblestone Pub in Smithfield at 6:30 on Wednesday, the 2nd of October, and I hope to see you there. So I'd just like to wrap up by thanking our panel, Lara Joy, Angela Byrne, and Captain Michael McKenna. I'd also like those in the audience who contributed from the floor, and we hope to see you in the back room of the Cobblestone maybe next Wednesday. There are still spaces left, by the way. Thank you very much.